We'll wait for other counsel to sit down. Yes, Your Honor. We'll now go to our final case for the day, 15-8013 and 16-8086, Eaton v. Pacheco. Counsel, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. I'm Sean O'Brien, and my co-counsel, Lindsay Reynolds and Terry Harris, and I represent Mr. Eaton. We've raised four issues in the briefs, and I want to talk about the first two today. The first issue being whether the district court abused its discretion in not considering all the factors in failing to prohibit a retrial of the penalty phase after finding that the trial attorney was ineffective for failing to talk to dozens of witnesses, and that had he done so and presented that testimony, Mr. Eaton would have presented a life sentence. 18 of the witnesses he relied on to grant relief and to make those findings are now deceased. Some were deceased prior to him making those rulings. Some have died during the pendency of the district court. And, you know, our argument, Your Honor, here is that this court should send it back for a more full consideration of all the relevant factors of federal remedies. The second issue deals with the competency to proceed issue that Judge Johnson applied incorrect legal standards in determining that the state court decision on Mr. Eaton's competence had to be respected pursuant to 2254D. So I'll begin with the first. Actually, let me say the remedy that we're asking for there again is to remand the case to Judge Johnson to do a proper assessment under 2254 D and E before determining that the that decision should be that claim should be rejected. Why that's important is that if you were to grant the writ on this claim, we would be entitled to a retrial of the guilt innocence phase of the trial and potential mental health defenses rather than just a retrial of the penalty phase. So let me begin with the first issue. The trial court, Judge Johnson's ruling that Mr. Skaggs, the trial attorney, failed to interview all of these witnesses, and that had he done so, Mr. Eaton would have been sentenced to life in all probability under the Schlup standard, that is the law of the case. It is an unappealed ruling. And so as we look at the remedy, we need to understand that there is a finding in this case that a retrial would have resulted in life. So the legal standard for the remedy is that it was Judge Johnson's obligation under 2243 and under this court's decision in Burton versus Johnson to fashion a remedy as law and justice requires. And this court and the U.S. Supreme Court have identified a number of criteria that are necessary to satisfy that obligation of the district court. The Supreme Court in Lafler versus Cooper said that the remedy must be tailored to the circumstances of the case and must restore the petitioner to the position he would have been in had his constitutional rights been respected at trial. Put another way, in Hannon versus
you're here now, though, on this issue on the denial of your Rule 59 motion, 59E, right?
Yes, that's correct.
And I guess you've got a kind of a significant preliminary problem in that you're trying to raise through a Rule 59 motion an argument you never made, you never asked. You asked for a conditional writ.
In the petition for writ of habeas corpus, we asked for a conditional writ.
How do you get to now say, gee, well, the judge should have done something different, and you're doing that on a Rule 59 motion?
In the post-hearing briefing, after we presented evidence to Judge Johnson of all of the witnesses who had died, and he made findings that this was an important witness and this witness is now deceased, our post-hearing briefing, we asked the judge for an unconditional discharge, that he should simply retry, that he should issue the writ of habeas corpus, setting aside Mr. Eaton's conviction and or setting aside his sentence of death, rather. And so it's not an issue that is a surprise to Judge Johnson or to the other side. And in the 59E pleadings, the appellee, then respondent, did not complain that this issue had not been presented earlier. And in fact, if you read Judge Johnson's ruling, it's very clear that this issue was very much on his mind. And so the question is whether or not his ruling, his decision on that 59E motion, addresses all of the criteria that this court says is relevant and essential. And I understand that the default remedy is a retrial of the penalty phase or the retrial of the guilt-innocence phase, depending on the nature of the error. But this court has acknowledged that the prohibition of a retrial, and in this case it would simply take the form of converting Mr. Eaton's sentence to life without the possibility of parole, that the court should consider such a remedy if a retrial would not vitiate the prejudice caused by the underlying constitutional violation. And that this, that in exceptional circumstances, that would be the appropriate thing for the court to do. There are a number of decisions of this court that acknowledge that that is the law, that the district court has the discretion to do that. And I acknowledge that that discretion is very limited. And the case that is perhaps most on point here, United States versus Bergman, the court acknowledged, this court acknowledged, that an example of exceptional circumstances might be a case in which so many witnesses have died and so much evidence has been lost that not even Daniel Webster could provide constitutionally adequate representation. And I think that's where we are with Mr. Eaton's case. Judge Johnson, in making the decision that the performance of trial counsel in failing to interview and present testimony of many witnesses, relied on fully 18 witnesses who are now deceased. And not even Daniel Webster could go interview those witnesses.
Let's concede that you've made a strong argument in that regard. What tribunal should be deciding this? Everything related to 2254 is comedy. Not comedy, comedy. And the state court gets the first crack at it. Shouldn't we let the state court? There's nothing preventing the state court from hearing your argument and saying, you're right. Too many people have died. This would be very unfair. But there'd be a full development of the factual basis at that stage. The court would rule. Maybe the court would rule against you, and maybe that'd be grounds for habeas relief second go round. Why shouldn't we defer to the state court in the first instance?
Several responses to that, Your Honor. First is that comity and federalism in this case have been respected in the form of Mr. Eaton giving the state of Wyoming the first opportunity to determine whether or not his constitutional rights were violated and to fashion the appropriate remedy for that. And the law of this case is that that Wyoming's attempt to do that is objectively unreasonable. And so in terms of comity and federalism, to some degree, that ship has sailed. They had their opportunity to rectify this constitutional violation. Number two, 2243 does not talk to state courts. It talks to federal courts. And the remedy for a constitutional violation found by a federal judge is committed under the law, Hilton versus Bronskill, to the sound discretion of the district court. The district court in this case is in the best position to make this determination because he heard 2 weeks of evidence and reviewed thousands and thousands of pages of documents and evidence in order to make this determination. He is best suited and, in fact, obligated under the law to determine the adequacy of the remedy that he has.
Well, he may have been in the best position. He may have been. He may have had the discretion, as you argue, to do this. Whether you properly asked him to or not is another question, but assuming you did, he may have had the discretion. But to say it was an abuse of discretion for him to decide that it would to send this to the state court and let them decide is a whole other matter, and I don't see any support for that.
Your Honor,
legal support.
The argument is not that he abused his discretion in the result, but that he abused his discretion in how he got there. That in ruling on the 59E, he applied the wrong standard.
Okay. Let's talk about that. Yeah.
Yes, as Justice O'Connor said in the Schlup decision, applying the wrong standard is a paradigmatic abuse of discretion. His reasoning can be summed up in two words: comity precludes. As if he had no discretion whatsoever.
Well, I don't think he said comity precludes. He didn't say that at all. I think he used the term "it'd be best to send it to state court."
Well, that was his reasoning, but he also, in his decision, and quoting what he perceived to be the, as he was quoting Younger versus Harris and citing authority, he cited to Levin versus Commerce Energy Incorporated, 560 U.S. 413, volume 18, page 1825 to 1826 of the transcript. Comity considerations would preclude the exercise of lower federal court adjudicatory authority over
right.
this controversy.
That's a quote. That's a quote from a parenthetical. Before that, in his text, he says, any arguments which may address issues associated with the resentencing, such as those raised by petitioner through his motion, he goes through them, are under the notion of comity, in quotations, best resolved by the state court system if a resentencing is, in fact, pursued. If they decide to pursue it, it's best resolved by that state court. That's what he said. What's the problem?
The point here is that the sole consideration was comity.
All right.
And looking at United States versus Morrison, 449 U.S. 361, the court said that the remedy for a right to counsel violation should be tailored to the injury suffered from the constitutional violation and should not unnecessarily infringe on competing interests. For Judge Johnson to assume that comity precludes him from granting this remedy or even considering this remedy as long as there is a judge sitting in Natrona County, Wyoming, is an incorrect statement of the law. He did not look at any competing interests. He didn't look at how compelling the state interests might be. And comity is a compelling state interest.
What is the competing interest here?
Pardon me?
What is the competing interest?
Well, on Mr. Eaton's part,
does it appear that the state court will be just totally unfair?
Well, the state court has been totally unfair. The question is whether or not the federal court should complete his obligation to fashion a remedy as law and justice requires under Section 2243. And in examining that, Judge Johnson should have looked at whether or not it is even possible for Wyoming to grant Mr. Eaton a constitutional retrial. The retrial that he could have had, or the trial that he should have had in 2004, cannot possibly be extended to him at the conclusion of these proceedings because of these circumstances. And so Mr. Eaton has a powerful interest in the vindication of his Sixth Amendment right to counsel. And that gets zero consideration by the court. And so the appropriate thing for this court to do would be to remand this case to Judge Johnson and have him examine and make findings on what are the competing interests here in this matter. With respect to the second issue, the competency issue, Your Honor, we're arguing that because Mr. Eaton was incompetent to proceed at the time of his trial, and that the state court made an erroneous determination of competency based on ineffective assistance of counsel, that Judge Johnson should have reviewed that without deferring to the state court. And again, looking at his findings that are now the law of the case with respect to our first argument, the ineffective assistance of counsel claim, Judge Johnson made some fairly significant findings that implicate the competency to be executed, or the competency to proceed finding as well. He found that Mr. Eaton surmounted a tall hurdle and has shown that the state court's decisions were based on an unreasonable determination of the facts in light of the evidence presented in state court proceedings, and granted an evidentiary hearing on claims 1, 2, and 4. You'll find that in volume 13, page 901 of the Record on Appeal. We alleged in the habeas petition the exact same performance deficiencies in with respect to claim 3 that were alleged with respect to claims 1, 2, and 4. And in fact, we incorporated the performance deficiencies of claim 2 into claim 3 by reference. So they rely on the same things. The district court found, after a hearing, made the following finding at a hearing that was properly conducted under 2254E. And there's no argument that he did do anything improper under 2254E. Listen to this finding. The mental health assessment by the forensic mental health experts who testified at trial on behalf of petitioner, in particular Dr. Ash, was adversely impacted by the paucity of documentation and instructions provided to them prior to petitioner's trial. The failure of the trial team to apprise Dr. Ash of their observations and interactions with petitioner prior to and during trial, and their failure to investigate and provide Dr. Ash important aspects of petitioner's developmental, psychiatric, and life history.
There are fundamental procedural issues here.
Yes, there are.
The district court granted summary judgment on the incompetence, alleged incompetence of counsel with respect to competency to stand trial. Granted summary judgment on a determination that the defendant was competent. That was the basis of it. That summary judgment was entered. The court then went on for further proceedings with respect to incompetence of counsel with respect to mitigation evidence, found there was incompetence and that the state courts had erred in that regard and were not entitled to deference, had an evidentiary hearing, and more evidence came out about his background and mental condition. Did you ever request the district court to reconsider the summary judgment based on that additional evidence?
We did not, Your Honor. Let me explain why. With respect to the competency issue, there was nothing new. Dr. Ash's...
So if there's nothing new, then you're not relying on the evidence developed at the evidentiary hearing to argue against the summary judgment. Is that correct?
Not in its entirety. Let me slice that a little thinner for you, Your Honor, because this language tracks exactly the affidavit by Dr. Ash that was presented to Judge Johnson with our petition. And Judge Johnson said, if I had known he was acting out during the trial, if I had known he was not cooperating with his defense at all, if I had known that essentially the trial lawyers were observing psychotic symptomology in their attorney-client visits, and had I known this history, I would have had to reconsider my assessment of competence and that should be redone. So that is the essence of what I just read that came out in the proper hearing. And so I think that's significant because of Justice Alito's concurrence in Cullen versus Penholster. But it's nothing new for Judge Johnson. He had all that information at the time of the summary judgment ruling.
At the time of the summary judgment ruling, he had proceed. I'm not quite sure I'm getting all the origins of the various evidence.
Right. At the time of the summary judgment ruling, he had been thoroughly advised and briefed on the significance of the background investigation on Dr. Ash's competency finding. And so with respect to the competency finding, in fact, I'm not sure if it was part of the record, but there was a pretrial discussion about whether we would be permitted even to get into it in this hearing, and we weren't.
When granting summary judgment, Judge Johnson considered only the evidence presented to the state court. Is that correct?
That's correct.
But now you want him to consider additional evidence, even though in resolving that claim, he properly didn't include any evidence not presented to the state court because he found that the state court's determination of competency was not unreasonable. Isn't that correct?
That is correct. Now, let me address that finding and the process by which he arrived at it, because there are several problems with that finding. Number one, there are two prongs of the Strickland argument. The first is that Mr. Skaggs performed deficiently.
Okay.
The second is that Mr. Eaton was prejudiced by that deficient performance on the competency issue.
Right.
And so the Wyoming Supreme Court decided not to look at the performance prong.
Well, that's not true. Not true at all. What are you relying on for that?
I'm relying on what they said. Paragraph P13 of their direct appeal opinion, the Supreme Court said, we intend only to address the initial premise that Eaton was not competent to stand trial.
That had to do with your due process claim, not your Sixth Amendment claim.
That had to do with the due process claim, but when they got to the ineffective assistance of counsel claim, they said, we already disposed of this.
When they got to the ineffective assistance of counsel claim, they said, we considered this issue, we have concluded that the record on appeal does not indicate that Eaton was not competent to be tried. Hence, we also conclude defense counsel were not ineffective for permitting the trial to go forward. How is that not a determination? There's nothing in the record. They say we see nothing in the record that indicates he was not competent to be tried, meaning it's not possible on the performance prong that trial counsel was ineffective for not further investigating his competence. How is that not a pretty clear ruling both on prejudice and performance prong?
Well, first of all, they said that they were only looking at performance, but
to the due process, you cite two statements, and they both seem to me to go to the due process claim.
But there's no new statement with respect to the ineffective assistance of counsel claim.
There's this very specific statement.
Right.
We conclude defense counsel were not ineffective for permitting the trial to go forward.
Right.
It's not much, but I don't know how you're going to get your new evidence there.
It's, the question
it's
is...
It's a decision on the merits.
It doesn't appear... There's no real discussion
there doesn't
of
have
the
to be.
Claim that we made in the federal court.
There doesn't have to be, it though, does there?
This court's recent decision in Pavitt, this court had to look at whether or not there was, you know, a reasoned decision. And the reasoning all flows from the prejudice prong. And so because he can't be prejudiced, there's no performance deficiency. That is, and in fact responded in the lower court in the briefing of this, told Judge Johnson that the Wyoming Supreme Court disposed of this issue using the prejudice prong of Strickland when we're talking about this case. So I think the record is clear on close examination that there wasn't any discussion of performance.
I'm not real clear on your argument. If we disagree with you that there was a discussion on performance, this one sentence goes to performance and prejudice, what's your argument then as to how we get to this?
Okay, there's another argument that is Harrington versus Richter, that the court under in Harrington versus Richter says that if there is no discussion, just simply a summary ruling, then the court can affirm, can deny habeas relief if there is any reasonable basis for the trial court's decision, which is kind of a far-reaching, you have to imagine things that the trial court might have done. Mm-hmm. And Judge Johnson disposed of this claim under the Harrington versus Richter standard. And that again triggers whether or not the proper standard was applied. And in Judge Johnson's defense, I mean, our petition was filed just within 60 days of the Supreme Court's decision in Cullen versus Penholster. So we're all plowing new ground in the district court. He applied Harrington versus Richter to both prongs of the Strickland test, and that's wrong. And that, again, as Justice O'Connor says, is a paradigmatic abuse of discretion.
Well, let's get to the substance of the competency.
Yes.
Even with the evidentiary hearing, what do you have? Do you have any expert saying that defendant was incompetent to stand trial?
Is it just the
Logan letter? Is that all you've got?
If the state court's ruling is unreasonable, and we contend it was under 2254D2 for a reason I'm going to tell you in a minute, then Judge Johnson could conduct a hearing, and at that point we should have the opportunity, because this was summary judgment.
Yeah, but the new evidence, you're going to put on new evidence a second go-round?
Let me tell you the 2254D2 argument, which is that when we talk about the Wyoming Supreme Court saying, well, you didn't ask for a hearing, and a hearing wouldn't have done him any good because Dr. Ash would have come in and said he was competent. Dr. Ash repudiated his competency determination in Dr. Logan's report. Dr. Logan told essentially the Wyoming Supreme Court that Dr. Ash said that if he had known these things, that Mr. Eaton wasn't cooperating with counsel, that he was acting out during trial, he would have to reconsider his competency determination. So that becomes the elephant in the room.
Well, why did that letter not go to the state trial court? Why was it not disclosed until you submitted it to the state Supreme Court?
It did go to the state Supreme Court.
Yeah, but why didn't it go to the state trial court, which made a factual finding on competence, a rather reasoned, well-developed position there? Why? And it might well have seen the Logan letter and continued to make the same finding, which we would have to defer to. Why was that not presented to the state trial court?
It was remanded to the trial court, and there was a summary proceeding, and there was a one letter. So it was presented back to the trial court. Right. And Judge Park rejected Dr. Logan's. But here's the key point is that the entire basis of the ineffective assistance of counsel ruling is that what good would a hearing have done on Mr. Eaton's competence if Dr. Ash would have just come in and said he was competent? So the Wyoming Supreme Court, when they made that finding, knew that Dr. Ash had questions about his competency finding. And so the whole decision rests on a conclusion by Dr. Ash that the Wyoming Supreme Court knew that he had repudiated.
Let me ask you another question on competence. It's been a while since this was remanded to the state court. What's happened with respect to a competency hearing in the present proceedings in state court?
My
understanding is the government wanted a competency hearing in state court, and the defendant resisted that.
Proceedings are stayed pending the decision of this court and the conclusion of these proceedings.
No resistance to a competency
hearing? There was resistance in that we've got work to do before we're ready to do that kind of evaluation. And it wasn't, no, he doesn't need one. It was that he needs one, but at a later time, after there's been some further investigation and development of the record. The 2254D findings with respect to claim numbers 1, 2, and 4, that the state court didn't give Eaton an opportunity to develop this claim, triggered the Supreme Court's decision in Brumfield versus Kane that if you didn't have an opportunity to develop the record, then the state court finding does violate 2254D in that it was there was good cause for the appellant in that case to develop the record further on his competency to be, at that point it was an Atkins decision. And so Brumfield versus Kane is also a very important decision that Judge.
Let me ask you one question on that decision. Did you argue in federal district court that the state court had unreasonably applied federal law in rejecting a further evidentiary hearing regarding competency?
Yes, Your Honor.
You did argue that?
Yes, Your Honor. The briefing is pretty thorough on that point.
Okay.
And so in terms of what I'm arguing here, there's nothing new that Judge Johnson wasn't aware of at the time of his summary judgment ruling. I see that I've used my time, unless you have additional questions.
Do you have a question?
No, I'm all right.
Okay. We're fine. Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Katie Adams. I'm Senior Assistant Attorney General with the Wyoming Attorney General's Office.
Would you lift the microphone up a little bit?
Yes, Your Honor. Is that better? And I'm here with my co-counsel, Benjamin Fisher, an Assistant Attorney General with our office. He's seated at counsel's table, and we represent the state of Wyoming in this matter. I want to start with the competency issue. As a preliminary matter, Eaton was not entitled to de novo review of counsel's performance. The general rule is that if the state court adjudicated only one prong of Strickland, then the district court must review de novo the prong that the state court did not adjudicate on the merits. But then building on those rules, we have Harrington, and then we also have this court's recent decision in Wood v. Carpenter. And in a footnote, this court stated that when the state court did not specify whether an ineffective assistance of counsel claim failed because there was no deficient performance under Strickland or because the defendant suffered no Strickland prejudice, AEDPA applies to both Strickland prongs. And so here, Eaton was not entitled to de novo review of counsel's performance because the Wyoming Supreme Court did not expressly address either prong of Strickland. The Wyoming Supreme Court denied Eaton's ineffective assistance of counsel claim based on its finding that Eaton was competent to stand trial. It stated, "We considered this issue as a substantive matter in Part 1A above, referring to paragraphs 13 to 30 of its decision. We have concluded that the record on appeal does not indicate that Eaton was not competent to be tried. Hence, we also conclude that defense counsel was not ineffective for permitting the trial to go forward." And here, I think we have another problem that needs to be addressed based on this court's recent decision in Grant v. Royal. The Wyoming Supreme Court made a substantive competency finding in its decision. It found that Eaton was competent to stand trial. And although Eaton challenged the Wyoming Supreme Court's substantive competency finding below, he does not challenge it on appeal. He raises an ineffective assistance of counsel claim. The Wyoming Supreme Court's substantive competency finding must either be treated as a factual issue. If so, it would be subject to Section 2254E1's presumption of correctness. And this court declined to definitively decide whether or not a substantive competency finding is a factual matter in Grant v. Royal. And then it went on to say that it would either be that or it would be considered a mixed question of law, in which case Eaton would have had to demonstrate that it was deficient under Section 2254D. But Eaton has not challenged the Wyoming Supreme Court's substantive competency finding on either basis on appeal, and I think that finding undermines his ability to establish prejudice as to counsel's performance. And the district court actually treated it as a factual matter in its order granting the state summary judgment. So I think that needs to be considered as far as prejudice in this case. Setting that problem aside, even if the district court should have reviewed performance de novo, that would not have permitted the district court to consider evidence that Eaton introduced for the first time in federal habeas proceedings. AEDPA, as interpreted by Colon v. Pinholster, limited the district court's consideration of Eaton's claim to the state court record. In Colon, the Supreme Court unequivocally held that review under Section 2254d1 is limited to the record before the state court that adjudicated the claim on the merits. And this court has extended that ruling to review under Section 2254d2. And so Eaton has argued both in his brief and in a supplemental authority to this court recently that there's a reference in some of the federal habeas case law to consideration of the totality of the available mitigation evidence, both that adduced at trial and the evidence adduced in the habeas proceeding. But if we look back at the origins of that statement in Porter v. McCollum, and we go back to what the courts were considering, that reference to the habeas proceedings is actually to the state habeas proceedings. And so in cases like Porter v. McCollum, Rompilla v. Beard, Wiggins v. Smith, and Williams v. Taylor, the courts reviewed for Strickland prejudice based on the totality of the mitigation evidence that was before the state court.
Well, it's a nice logical argument. I've got a problem. In Wyoming, there's no mechanism to challenge ineffective assistance of appellate counsel. Is that correct?
It should be raised on direct appeal.
And in this case, there are all sorts of problems with that, which Judge Johnson found. There was the conflict of interest, et cetera, that prevented counsel from being effective, but there wasn't a habeas proceeding in state court by which that claim could have been made. Is that accurate?
On appellate counsel's effectiveness?
Yes.
That's correct.
Okay. So appellate counsel is totally ineffective and doesn't make an argument showing that additional investigation could have established the defendant's incompetence to stand trial. And then we're just stuck with that? It seems to me that, as in Broomfield, not quite exactly the same thing, but you've shown that there is a clear, well, let me back up. Here, there's no mechanism to show ineffective assistance of appellate counsel, so that is reviewed de novo in federal district court. And on that de novo review, you show the prejudice arising from that ineffective assistance of appellate counsel was that evidence wasn't presented to the state court that would have shown incompetence of the defendant. And you're saying even then, the federal court can't look at evidence of incompetence and anew and determine, essentially you're determining the remedy for ineffective assistance of appellate counsel, and you're saying that's foreclosed? Maybe that's what Congress said. I think most courts would be resistant to arriving at that conclusion unless the statutory language is just crystal clear that way.
Well, Your Honor, I think there's a problem in this case in terms of conflating the finding of ineffective assistance of appellate counsel as to mitigation and as to those issues with the competency issue. And really, Eaton hasn't challenged what I think constrained appellate counsel's ability to develop some of the record. He hasn't challenged Wyoming rule of appellate procedure 21, which is what put the time limit on appellate counsel's ability to develop some of the record. He hasn't challenged that as a due process violation, and he could have done so. He also could have presented appellate counsel's ineffectiveness as a separate claim, and he hasn't done that. He's sort of trying to bootstrap in some of these other concepts to what is clearly a limitation under AEDPA and Pinholster.
You're saying he hasn't made a claim of ineffective assistance of appellate counsel with respect to the competency issue? Is that what you just said? I want to make sure I understood your point. What hasn't been preserved?
The claim that's on appeal is ineffective assistance of trial counsel for not raising the issue of competency and for not adequately investigating Mr. Eaton's competence. So we're not here on the ineffective assistance of appellate counsel. We're here on ineffective assistance of trial counsel. And so I think we need to be constrained to that issue. And actually, referring to Dr. Logan...
So on that issue, we're restricted to the state court record because on the state court record, we can't say that 2254 D1 or 2 requires setting aside the state court's determination. Is that what you're... Is that basically...
If I understand the question correctly, yes, Your Honor.
I was hoping you'd help me understand better. But.
Well, we're limited to looking at the Wyoming Supreme Court's adjudication of the claim and the evidence that was before the Wyoming Supreme Court at the time that it adjudicated the claim. And I want to refer to
And we're limited to that.
Yes.
Because there hasn't been a showing under 2254 D1 or D2 that the state court unreasonably determined that counsel, that there was no ineffectiveness of trial counsel with respect to the competency issue.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
And that's in Brumfield, that's a distinction because in that case, they were able to overcome the limitations of 2254D, and that's how we got to the issue of the hearing, and whether or not a hearing was denied was part of the issue with 2254D. And so I don't think that case is directly analogous here. In terms of the district court's decision on Eaton's Rule 59e motion, I want to go back to precisely what the district court said in its order. It stated that any arguments which may address issues associated with a resentencing, such as those raised by Eaton through his motions, i.e., the availability of mitigation witnesses, the ability to impanel an unbiased jury, and Fifth and Fourteenth Amendment protections are, under the notions of comity, best addressed by the state court system if a resentencing is in fact pursued. The district court then quoted Younger v. Harris at length and related cases on comity. And through those citations, the district court recognized that there is an adequate state court forum to hear Eaton's constitutional challenges to resentencing. And the district court did not abuse its discretion either in granting a conditional writ in the first instance or in denying the Rule 59e motion. Most of Eaton's argument centers on the notion that he cannot receive effective assistance of counsel at resentencing because too many mitigation witnesses have died or become unavailable since his trial. Both parties recognize that this court's decision in United States v. Bergman is instructive, both on remedies and the issue of loss of mitigation witnesses. As set forth there, habeas remedies must be tailored to the injury. The presumptively appropriate remedy for trial with an ineffective lawyer is a new trial with an effective one. And it would be a high price for society to pay were every accused granted immunity from trial because of any defect sufficient to constitute reversible error in the prior proceeding. The court then acknowledged that those general rules do not mean that a district court may never refuse to permit a new trial after finding a Sixth Amendment violation. It noted that barring retrial may well be a reasonable remedy when, for example, it's clear even competent counsel could not provide adequate representation in a new proceeding. It then went on to discuss the Daniel Webster example and it ultimately found that the district court in that case did not adequately justify barring retrial in Bergman's case. And I think it's important here to note what Bergman did not say. Bergman did not state that a retrial must be barred under such circumstances. It only stated that retrial may be barred, or that it may well be a reasonable remedy. And so even if we were to assume, for the sake of argument, that these are the circumstances contemplated by Bergman, it does not follow that the district court necessarily abused its discretion. Statutorily, district courts have authority under Section 2243 to dispose of habeas matters as law and justice require. The district court deemed a conditional writ the remedy that law and justice require after several years of proceedings, after hundreds of pages of pleadings and exhibits, after a 2-week evidentiary hearing, and as part of a 375-page decision that acknowledged the loss of mitigation witnesses and set those out. It denied Eaton's motion to modify just a couple months later, and so the district court was not only well aware of the facts at issue, but it was also in the best position to determine what remedy was just both to Eaton and to the state. In light of Bergman, I think there's a strong argument that the district court would have abused its discretion had it barred resentencing, because it's not clear that even competent counsel cannot provide adequate representation on resentencing. In his Rule 59e motion and in this court, Eaton has focused on the live witness testimony that he's lost as a result of the time since his trial and ineffective assistance of counsel. But he has not addressed the case that he can present to a jury. And it's understandable that he hasn't, because he doesn't want to preview that for the state. But at the same time, the district court, this court, and the state are left to speculate as to what type of case counsel can put on and whether or not they can provide adequate representation. In terms of representation, Eaton has received excellent representation in his federal habeas proceedings. He will continue to be represented by that same team of attorneys in the state court, where he's currently represented by them. And so they will be able to bring all of their extensive knowledge of this case, their research, their knowledge of death penalty cases to the new proceedings. And there's a clear path for review to any decisions which are adverse to Eaton. He can raise these issues in the state trial court in the first instance. If the state trial court allows resentencing and the jury imposes the death penalty, he can appeal to the Wyoming Supreme Court. If the Wyoming Supreme Court affirms his sentence, he can then raise this issue in post-conviction relief proceedings in the state court under a recent change to our post-conviction relief rule. And after exhausting state remedies, he can then petition for federal habeas relief. But bypassing that process would be contrary to federal state comity interests that underscore AEDPA, and it would cut against AEDPA's exhaustion requirement, which I think is something that the district court implicitly recognized. And so the state would ask that the decision be affirmed and that we would move forward in the state court.
Let me ask you a question about the status of competency proceedings in state court. Do you agree with the description of what happened by defense counsel?
I don't entirely agree, Your Honor. Within 45 days of the district court's conditional writ, the state district attorney moved or filed a notice of intent to seek the death penalty, moved for appointment of counsel, and moved for a competency determination. Mr. Eaton pretty vehemently opposed a competency finding. He submitted documents to the state trial court that in counsel's assessment he was competent to proceed, moved so that he would not have to attend any proceedings. And then when the state, again...
Who would not have to attend?
Mr. Eaton would not have to attend any state trial proceedings, that he would waive his presence.
Oh.
And then as we moved forward and the district court decided that a competency evaluation needed to be completed, we had briefing that very strongly opposed a competency evaluation for much the same reason that original trial counsel opposed a competency evaluation, that they do not want a contrary finding and an evaluation by the state hospital that could cut against a mitigation case. And so as a result of the district court ordering that a competency evaluation proceed, we then had the motion for a stay in the federal district court. And
that's
so I
quite
would,
different from what defense counsel described. And I think that raises an equitable issue. Habeas is an equitable proceeding. If they're saying we should determine, we should set aside the competency finding in the first proceeding, mm-hmm. and they're taking exactly the same position in this proceeding, I think equity would say you're not entitled to that sort of relief. That's rather troublesome. Maybe we should have some briefing on that. That bothers me a great deal. That's gamesmanship.
Your Honor, we would be happy to brief that issue.
Well, let us consult on that, but we may ask.
I want to make one brief point, if there are no more questions on that issue, on the Brady claim. It's our position that Eaton's Brady claim is moot as to the penalty phase. The district court granted the state summary judgment on Eaton's Brady claim in 2012. That was more than 2 years before it issued the conditional writ vacating Eaton's sentence in 2014. The remedy for a Brady violation in the sentencing phase would have been to vacate Eaton's sentence. That's precisely what he requested in his petition.
Do we really even have an issue before us on the Brady claim on the actual trial stage? We granted a COA on that. Whether error in the guilt-innocent stage of trial was material to the question of punishment under a capital sentencing scheme that allows the sentencing jury to consider all evidence adduced in the guilt-innocent stage at trial. I think you're saying we don't. I understand your argument as to the penalty phase issue being moot, but I'm wondering if we have anything left of that based on the COA.
Your Honor, I don't think we do.
You didn't make that argument, but.
I don't think we do, except to the extent that evidence from the guilt-innocence phase was then brought into the penalty phase. But if we really look at how Dax's testimony was used, he didn't testify in the penalty phase. He was mentioned in one sentence of the entire penalty phase on a different issue unrelated to the aggravating circumstances. And so I don't believe that he can prove materiality. And it's moot as well.
Thank you.
If there are no further questions, the state respectfully requests that this court affirm the district court in all respects.
I did have one question on the Rule 59 issue. I'm struggling with the fact that he didn't seem to request. I mean, that this is a brand new argument he's making, at least from what I can see, and he represents that he did perhaps ask the court to for an unconditional writ. Do you agree with that?
I disagree, Your Honor. In the petition, he asked for a conditional writ, essentially. Right. And Rule 59E is pretty limited to misapprehension of facts, a party's position, or the controlling law.
Was there any obligation for the trial court anyway to sua sponte consider the remedy as something other than what
I think
the district court to consider? I didn't quite understand his argument on it, I guess. But I did not see where he requested an unconditional writ.
I didn't either, Your Honor, and I think
there's some place other than the petition that seemed to be what he was referring to in his answer to me. Is there someplace else where he might have?
From my understanding from the reply brief, he mentioned loss of mitigation witnesses in the evidentiary hearing.
Right.
And that's the only place that
I'm in the evidentiary hearing. Right.
Right.
Any questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Your time has expired, but I'm going to give you a couple minutes to try to defend yourself, because I'm not real happy with what I've heard.
I am grateful for the opportunity, Your Honor. May it please the Court.
I'm going to first...
And I'm limiting this to your representation about what's happened in competency hearings in state court and how you, number one, whether you misrepresented what happened just now, and second, whether you're gaming us.
Yes. I'm sorry, I was distracted for a minute. I lost my legal pad. The first question you want to hear is
did you not represent accurately what had been happening in the competency proceedings in state court after the remand? The version of the state was rather different from yours. And second, if that version is correct, the version of the state, are you just gaming us here? Are you asking us to set it aside for incompetence of counsel when you're doing exactly the same thing on remand?
No, Your Honor. And I would encourage the Court to invite the parties to give you supplemental briefing on this. I think you would understand if you saw the pleadings from the state court and had us explain to you what exactly is happening. Number one, there are issues under Estelle versus Smith in which the government's request is also asking for determination of not guilty by reason of insanity and diminished mental capacity, which they are not entitled to until we inject that defense. We're not in a position to inject that defense until we have done our own mental evaluation. And so, number one, it is a resource issue that the defense counsel, you know, was barely in place and barely had a funding mechanism and didn't yet have funding mechanisms for our own experts and investigators. And so it was too fast out of the gate to be doing a competency determination before we do this. Number two, there are some different circumstances and a different time frame with respect to competency, and they are two different issues. There's an Eighth Circuit decision, Shaw versus Armantrout, in which the Supreme Court or the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals says competency in this time frame is a different issue from competency in this other time frame.
Well, but it would only cut. It seems to me that the fact that you're incompetent, that he may be incompetent now, may not mean he's incompetent earlier. I'd have a hard time seeing how he could be incompetent then and not incompetent now.
Right.
So I'm not sure how that's going to cut. But they're different
symptoms,
issues. But
yeah, symptoms wax and wane. But the bottom line is, Judge, there will be a competency hearing at some point if this state moves, if the state moves forward with this. That's the question.
Okay.
And I think if we address this, I think we could address the court's concern.
Okay.
Number two, the other thing that I wanted to...
Very briefly.
Pardon me?
Maybe I was wrong. I thought this time
had
expired.
He didn't have it.
Oh, I'm sorry. I was reading the clock.
No. I mean,
before,
when he sat down originally, he had used his entire time.
I had, Your Honor.
Okay.
The other thing I wanted to mention is that Ms. Adams said that we didn't challenge Wyoming Rule 21. It did not exist at the time that Mr. Eaton was going through the post-conviction Kayleen process. And, in fact, if you look at our briefs on page 14 through 15, we talk about the challenge to the process that was in place without the benefit of a rule and how that triggered 2254D2. And so that is in the record, and we did challenge it. And so because of that, I encourage the court to look at the discussion between Justice Sotomayor and Justice Thomas in Pinholster itself, because the argument in the state court was that he didn't ask for a competency hearing, and that was the claim. The claim here is that he did not investigate and provide evidence to his expert, and that would have produced different testimony. That's a different claim. And so the 2254D, we may be talking about a different claim here, which the court can reach through 2254D2 and the Brumfield versus Kane reasoning. So thank you, Your Honor. I appreciate the court's indulgence.
Thank you, counsel. Case is submitted. Counsel are excused. There's a good chance we'll ask for a supplemental briefing. And are we adjourned or is it recessed till tomorrow? We're not using. Okay, thank you.